What is the science of reading? What are leaders doing to accelerate reading achievement? We answer these questions and more in Science of Reading Leadership, Guiding Minds, Transforming Lives, powered by Just Right Reader.
All right, welcome to the Science of Reading Leadership podcast. Thank you so much for being here. We have an excellent, excellent episode today because today we have Doris Baker with us. Doris Baker is an associate professor in the Department of Special Education in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction at the University of Texas, Austin. Dr. Baker is engaged in developing and evaluating instructional tools and assessments in English and in Spanish designed to improve and monitor the academic performance of English learners without learning difficulties in reading, science, and social studies. She is also fluent in English, Spanish, Portuguese, and semi-fluent in German. Dr. Baker, welcome. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. Yeah.
I just want to be semi-fluent in another language. I mean, so the fact that you're fluent in so many is so awesome and so impressive. So welcome. I want to jump right in with our first question. And that question is, how did you get into the field of education? What led you to pursue this research in literacy? What made you so passionate?
Yeah, sure. Yes. Yeah. I would be glad to share it. Yeah. So I was born, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story because it kind of leads to that, to answering that question. I was born in Brazil. And then when I was 3 years old, I moved to Colombia and we lived in Colombia until I was 15 for 12 years. And then from there, we moved to Mexico. And then I lived in Mexico with my parents. I did my undergraduate degree there in psychology. And then I got married and then came to the States and did my master's in Latin American studies and then my doctorate at the University of Oregon. And I did my doctorate late while I was raising kids and trying to figure out what I wanted to do. But in the meantime, I taught Spanish too at the university. And one of the things that I found was that there were a lot of offices and schools that had a large immigration of Spanish-speaking students and Latino students, Latino families, and they didn't know what to do with them because they couldn't speak the language. So there was always this kind of like disconnect between what students wanted, who they were, what they knew, and the teachers. And so while I created a couple of courses where my students who are practicing Spanish and learning Spanish would go to the schools and help the kids. And they would come back and tell me stories, right? And so the stories were like, oh, they are frustrated in school. They don't understand anything. All they want to do is just go out and get to work. Can you help me with a resume? And that's what they wanted my students to do. And so that was what really inspired me to go back to school and try to figure out, well, what can we do for English learners, particularly students who are struggling? And they probably feel terrible because they have been struggling for a long time and nobody really has to had been able to help them, not to really support them in their reading trajectory and academic trajectory. And so I did my PhD and I continued kind of focusing on bilingual students, English learners. And then there was an opportunity to come to Texas. And I thought, well, this is going to be perfect because the population is bilingual, you know, for the most part, at least almost 40%.
You know that our podcast is primarily about, you know, not just the science of reading on an instructional level, but also on a leadership level. We have a lot of leaders across the country who are now having to help teachers embrace this. So can you tell us just a little bit more overall about what does the science of reading or other research say about bilingual learners?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so the science of reading, you know, it's sometimes a little bit controversial in the bilingual world because many times, you know, in bilingual programs, we think that the science of reading only applies to English and to learning English, but doesn't apply to other languages. And in fact, you know, we have research, international research that shows that the science of reading works with any language. I mean, even languages that are not alphabetic, but for example, logographic like Chinese or syllabics such as Korean. No? I mean, the idea that you learn to read by understanding the sounds or the phonemes or, you know, in some cases, the syllables or how the words are pronounced in Chinese, it works the same. I mean, you need to be told how to do that, and you need to practice it, and provide many opportunities for students to practice that those skills. And then the concepts, right? Like vocabulary, you need vocabulary in every language. You need, we need to comprehend what we're reading, which is also goes across languages, as well as fluency and decoding, right? I mean, also depending on the language, of course, we have to take into account the differences. And for example, in Spanish and in English, many times you might hear that Spanish is a syllabic language and the syllables should be taught more frequently than in English. And to a certain extent, that is true. But on the other hand, Spanish, for example, is also an alphabetic language. So each letter is a symbol for a sound. And therefore, the syllables in a word are not enough to provide students with the supports they need to really understand how the alphabetic system works, and how language, how letters are representations of sounds. So how do we translate that now into a system, right? The school system. And I think that the most important thing is to recognize that bilingual students, their differences, and sometimes they are very heterogeneic, maybe even more than English-only students because of their backgrounds and languages and language exposure and many other contexts, right, where they live. And so understanding that they might need a little bit more support than students in the regular classroom. Yeah, perhaps not so much in decoding. They can learn it with students who are English-only speakers the same way, and that would not be a problem. But in understanding the, a text, or in also the vocabulary, they will have a smaller vocabulary in if you assess them in one language or the other. It could be Spanish, it could be English, and so you want to really emphasize vocabulary during your instruction, independently whether it is, a content, math, science, geography, history, or whether it is reading or writing. The vocabulary is really key to supporting students to learn and be successful academically.
So when you think about our learners as second language learners, right? You talked about just a minute ago, you talked about the support that they need in order to read, right? How would you say it's different for a child who's already proficient in English so that we can kind of understand what we might need in order to support them both in the classroom?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so for example, if the student has learned the code, right, to break the code, just like an English-only student in the early grades, well, they will be fine and comparable in that skill, across different groups. But what will be key, for example, is like, let's say you want to do now, you do a read aloud, or you have kids read a text at their level, and then you want them to discuss it. And there's where the problem comes, because for English learners, they might need, that language to really be able to express themselves and to understand it. And sometimes we might think like, oh, they didn't get the story, or they didn't understand it. But it might not have been that. It could be that they just didn't know how to express it. They understood the topic and the text, but they just didn't know how to express it. And so really paying attention to those details and understanding that no matter what you teach, the vocabulary component for English language always has to be there. And ideally, because it's complicated, right? And what words you teach and how many words. And so if you can work with other teachers from your same grade or across grades to kind of determine the type of vocabulary that they will really be important for them, then everybody can focus on it. No, and everybody benefits from vocabulary instruction. What we have seen, though, with the research is that it's kind of like the growth is parallel. So everybody will benefit from vocabulary instruction, but the kids who have a very strong vocabulary will, grow faster and learn more than students that don't have that background, and don't have a strong vocabulary. But it doesn't mean that they don't learn it. It's just that they have like a lot to catch up, let's say.
Are there any vocabulary instructional practices or vocabulary routines that you have seen particularly effective for English language learners?
Yeah, what I've been focusing more now, and I'm kind of focusing more on science, social studies, but is like kind of teaching keywords in depth. So you know, we need a lot of more words than just that, no? Some kind of the receptive vocabulary. But I think that sometimes, like key concepts, if we can explain them to students, you know, at a deeper level, then they will be able to use that to connect them with other concepts and other vocabulary that is also important and connected across domains and across content areas. So I think that teaching directly a few words, right? Like we sometimes talk about maybe 5 to 6 words per week that are deeply taught. And it can vary, of course, for you know, younger kids, maybe 3, 4, for older kids could be more. But really kind of think about the vocabulary in terms of how do you use it? Like, what is the context? What other words can you associate them with so that they really build that kind of background knowledge, you know, through vocabulary? Yeah.
And then when we think about building that vocabulary or building that background knowledge, how would you say that school leaders should assess the literacy development over time?
Yeah, excellent question. Yeah, so I think that on one hand, of course, you know, we want to assess the vocabulary over time, but I think that what you'll find is also that, you know, students will learn, comprehend better across time too, because they are building the background knowledge, you know, for understanding. So I think that continuing with, you know, comprehension instruction and building that vocabulary and comprehension. I mean, I was connecting it both. So it's not like just, you know, learn this list of words, but how are the words associated with what we're talking about and how can you use them in what context? And I think that for principals, like hearing kids talk, you know, at a more, let's say, academic level, I mean, it's really exciting. And I think that's what, you know, you can kind of tell everybody, you know, I want to hear kids, you know, saying words like fleet or you know, speed or something brilliant outside the classroom, you know, as much as inside the classroom. So really kind of keep creating that culture of, you know, words are fun to use and are fun to explore and are fun to work with others, you know, and getting points for kids. Like, for example, I know that some teachers, sometimes they read books to kids aloud and then they have stickers about the words that kids repeat. And then if they, you know, I don't know, get to like 10 stickers because students read those words or learned or practiced those words outside the classroom, they get like an ice cream day on Friday, something like that. So that
it's gamification, really, incentivizing. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Dr. Baker, in terms of early learners who maybe are multilingual learners or are new to the English language, is there anything different that you know of that could be done to support those youngest learners of English?
Yeah, you know, I think that what I find is that, you know, for example, let's say you're doing phonemic awareness activities, right, which are all kind of like just sound and auditory, like providing them with a picture, no, with a picture of the word so that they are learning the words. And that's not the focus of the lesson, but you still want to focus on the sounds. But still, like, you know, all the visuals that you can provide will really help children, you know, understand those words, no, and get excited about it, too. I still remember a little anecdote here, but I remember that I was in a kindergarten class and we were talking about, you know, like high frequency, well, words that kids have just learned. And one of them was mole, which is a very, you know, like highly decodable word. And, you know, you learn it in the early year grades, like kindergarten, first grade. And in Spanish is topo, which is the same thing, like have very, you know, common vowel and letter sounds. And I showed them a picture of them, of a mole, and the kids were like so excited to see the mole because they had never seen one. No? So you can imagine the conversations, right? Like, oh, it doesn't have eyes and how come he has such long nails and where do they live? And so we really kind of, in a way, after practicing the decoding, we got engaged in this conversation that built the background knowledge, built their understanding, and in Spanish and in English, no, because we could also do it, you know, talk about the, for example, the animal in Spanish, but also show them how, you know, it's used in English, and that way they could really connect to it, you know, and learn the words. So for the early kids, it's really nice to, you know, if you can incorporate their native language into the discussion, that really helps.
That's such the visual piece too, is such an easy way to really start to bridge that gap for meaning. I can envision a phonemic aware, you know, a phonemic awareness routine. And as you're going through and breaking down, you know, segmenting and blending words, I can just imagine, hey, a quick Google and you can have the picture up too.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
And then you know, that solid connection also reinforces it so that it helps with the fluency. It helps with that automaticity. It helps with that retention so that it can become a high frequency word that becomes something that they don't forget. So I love that. I love that a lot. Yeah. We've talked a lot in this work, right? On our podcast specifically too, we've talked about the importance of family engagement, the importance of leveraging the home, the importance of engaging our communities. So what recommendations do you have for supporting bilingual literacy at home, especially for parents who may not be fluent in English themselves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. You asked me the question that I'm very passionate about and a firm believer. And I still do research on that. I just got a large grant on precisely that topic. So, I think that the parents have such an important role for kids to develop their language and their academic really preparation, no, for school. And I think that conversations are key, and that's something that, you know, we just don't think about it, but trying to converse with the children in the native language is really helpful. Reading aloud to them in their native language, it really kind of helps reinforce, build vocabulary, reinforce their identity also and their communication, you know, with parents, and they can do it in their language. They don't have to do it in English. No, I remember working with some parents one time, and the mom would tell me, "Well, my husband wants me to speak English to my child, but I just don't speak English." And so it was like, no, don't worry, you can speak Spanish to them, because the problem is that if they try to speak in a language that maybe where they're weaker in, then the conversation becomes quite stilted, right? I mean, like, you know, it's a yes, no questions and, you know, very simple things. And then if the kid doesn't understand the mom, then it becomes frustrating, or the other way around. And so just speaking in the native language and doing read alouds with them. And really, for example, in this study that we did, we used books to work with parents that we knew the teacher was going to read to kids in the classroom. And this was not a bilingual classroom, it was an English only classroom, but when the kids, you know, recognized the books in the classroom that they were reading at home, they were so excited. You can just imagine. And in fact, one of the kids corrected the teacher because the teacher said the name of the author wrong. And so he was like, "Oh no, it's not David. I don't know whatever the teacher said, but it's David Pearson." And so it was really interesting to see how the kids recognized and really paid attention. I knew that they had been reading with their parents because of their reaction. No, so the more interaction with the kids, with books that are simple, it doesn't have a lot of reading. We don't want the parents to feel like overwhelmed or not know what to do with a book if the kid is bored. And so what, you know, but really engage with them in a conversation about the book. And
what confidence that would build to have had that experience at home before coming into the classroom. Can you specify too the books that they were reading at home? Were they in English or in their native language before coming to school?
Yeah, for this study, we used English, Spanish books. So, you know, The Very Hungry Caterpillar, but in Spanish, and, Maurice and Maxwell worked about monsters and things like that. Yeah. But, there are many ways of doing it, but we decided to use books that we knew the kids were going to be exposed in the classroom. So it was kind of like a bit of a pre-preparation, pre-teaching.
I love that idea.
I do too. I love that.
Yeah, you couldn't probably do it with every single book, but if you had some really strong anchor text that you knew you were using throughout the year to go ahead and purchase those for families in a native language, I just can't imagine the confidence that would breed. So.
Oh, I think so too. Exactly. Yeah. I think that would be fantastic. Yeah. And then, builds background knowledge for the kids too. So they know, they understand what's going on. And because it's so interactive, no, I mean, we don't want them to necessarily just kind of read a book and be done, but talk about it, no, talk about the characters, talk about, you know, what they see, the landscape, you know, the message of the book. I mean, there's so many ways of looking at it, yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Just Right Reader. Extend phonics instruction, strengthen school-home partnerships, and accelerate reading achievement with take-home decodable packs from Just Right Reader. Personalized take-home packs make phonics fun and accessible for families. Every book comes with a video phonics lesson and writing pages to help readers reinforce their decoding and writing skills. To learn more, visit justwritereader.com.
We'd love to know a little bit more about the challenges that you have seen district leaders face. What do you think those biggest challenges are that they're facing in supporting English learners? And what have you seen, or what does the research show that they could do to overcome those challenges?
Yeah, exactly. There are many things, right, of course. But I think that one of the most important things, and I think at least the schools I have been visiting, they do embrace it, but it's the recognition that we have two languages in the school, that all students will learn, and there is not a separation sometimes that, you know, some of the bilingual teachers sometimes feel that they are left a little bit behind or on the side because, materials or trainings tend to be in English, and then, you know, somebody translates them into Spanish, and so sometimes the books are in Spanish are black and white, and other times, you know, in the English speaking students, they have this nice, colorful, you know, set of books. So there are this kind of like details now that I think makes a little bit of a difference that students feel like, well, you know, I want the book like my peer has. So that's one. The other one is embracing really the bilingualism and the recognition of the context of where the school is at, and try to invite parents to come to meetings. They might not always come, and it's not because they don't want to, but it's because, two jobs, three jobs, trying to figure out life. And so that would be the reason. But I think it's not, there's no reason for not kind of engaging them, no, and really kind of working with them. I have, for example, now a doctoral student that did a very interesting study where she looked at the amount of communication that happened between principals and schools and parents during COVID. And so it was interesting to see the types of communication that the district leaders would give parents. And so, and you realize how much more you can do, you know, even if there is not like a presential thing. I mean, nowadays, everybody has Facebook, everybody has a cell phone. So sending messages, I mean, like kind of reminding parents that we care, we want their child to do well, we want them to participate in activities. Sometimes there's a little bit of misunderstanding from parents about, for example, what summer classes are. And so some parents think that summer classes are for remedial kids, and so they don't want the kid to go to the class because, you know, the kid says, oh, no, I want to spend the summer outside, or because they think that it's more for people that, you know, they're not doing well. And so it's a little bit embarrassing. And so there are these misunderstandings that are not, you know, no parent will say, oh, my kid thinks that these courses are not worth it for him to go, so I'm not taking them. But recognize that might be a problem. And so really thinking about how parents perceive education. Another thing that I've noticed, for example, living in different countries, is that in other countries, the teachers are highly respected. And so whatever they do, whatever the teacher says, that's the last word, and that's what you follow. And so when they just expect, you know, that the school will take care of their kids, and sometimes in here, you know, we have a little bit more of an approach that, you know, the parent has to get involved to really get all the what the kid needs, no? And so trying to really understand that dynamic and see that, for example, if they don't work at home, or they don't practice with the kids or do their homework, it's because, it's not because they don't care, it's because they don't think that that's their role, no? First of all. And many times also they might not understand, they might not speak English, they might not be able to really support their children, no? But what I found is that, you know, with very simple and brief workshops, you can really get parents excited about, reading with their children, or coming to school and asking questions, and looking up, you know, attending, going to the library and looking for books, because that's a a good thing to do for your child. And so, you know, you can really engage them very quickly. It's just, you know, like to kind of train them, not do workshops for them so that they know also why this is important, you know.
So can you share, we have a lot of teachers who listen to the podcast, right? So I know we're always looking for ways to do things in a successful way. Can you share a success story in a classroom that you've observed or where you've been in where a teacher is successfully promoting like bilingual literacy using principles that you've seen?
Several in different contexts, but I think that one of the teachers that impressed me the most that I observed was a teacher that she was you know, she was born in the States, but then she lived in Chile for a very long time. She was married to a Chilean teacher, I think it was too, and she really, she had a bilingual classroom where they were English speakers and there were also Spanish speakers in the class. So it was tricky, you know, for example, teaching the phonemes. That was one of the things that she was doing when I observed and we recorded her. She addressed, for example, the issue with vocabulary, you know, like the words that student could not know by providing them with a picture. She also did a lot of modeling for the students. So, for example, you know, like let's say the sounds in cat, you know, and so my turn, k, at, now your turn, you know, like so the sounds in cat are k, at, now give me the sounds in dog and do og. No, and so she would always model and then provide students with a lot of practice opportunities. And here, what was fun is that to see too is because really phonemic awareness or phonics is a very kind of discrete skill that you teach, right? Like very small pieces. So the kids could participate and you didn't have to worry about like, oh, these kids are Spanish speakers. They might not understand all the sounds than English speakers because, you know, it's an auditory thing. So if you hear the sound, you can say it, even if you might not know the word, you know, but so I was impressed by that, by how she was able to, you know, get all the kids to respond and practice and active with both of the, you know, with both languages, no?
Yeah. Beautiful. I love that. That's such a great idea. We always ask the same question of our guests when they come on, because we know that district leaders and educators have so much on their plate and we're always receiving so much information. And you've given us a lot of great information and stories and great things. So if for our listeners, what is the one thing from this conversation that you would say is the most important takeaway that you want them to leave with?
Yeah. Well, I think that the first one and foremost is that Spanish and English are both alphabetic languages, and therefore the letters are symbols for sounds, and then we need to teach the letter sounds to children and not just like, you know, show me the sound of this letter and with the cards. I mean, of course, this is part of it, but understanding that the system, that both systems are the same, no? So I think it's okay to explicitly tell a student, oh, you know, the sound in the letter L in English is L, and guess what? In Spanish, it's also L, you know? So they really also understand that there is a connection between the languages and that what they are learning one language, they can really apply to the other language. I think that is really one of the key points, because there is a lot of that separation about all Spanish and English, and we don't kind of like go across. And comprehension, you know, like, I mean, what kids are going to need if you're doing comprehension in English is they're going to need the vocabulary. I mean, we cannot live without that. And of course, if they have bilingual teachers, they understand. If they can speak in Spanish and explain something, I mean, that would be great, very desirable, but it doesn't always happen, right? So, and if it doesn't happen, that's okay. But just think about the vocabulary that kids will need to actually respond to the questions. Yeah. There are many things, but I think that those would be like
the big ones. Yes. Well, that is all the time we have today on the podcast. Dr. Baker, thank you so much for being here on today's episode. We have learned an incredible amount from your research and experience and wisdom. And so thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for joining us. If you found this conversation valuable, please subscribe and leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. We will see you next time on Science of Reading Leadership, Guiding Minds, Transforming Lives.